Yeah, we. I wanted to discuss again where we're doing the Aseret HaDibrot, and of course, sure,
Thank you.
And of course, as you know, and as I've repeated a number of times, our Chachamim tell us that Anochi and Lo Yiyalecha, they count as two, right? And every list of the commandments, they are the first two. But in point of fact, there are some questions. The first question is, who says the first one is a commandment at all? Remember that there's a machlokes, Rambam and Ramban. Is there a commandment called Anochi? Anochi is not in the form of a commandment. Anochi is in the form of a declarative sentence, I am the Lord your God. So here, we talked about it last week, just to reiterate very quickly. According to Maimonides, according to the Rambam, it indeed is a commandment. It is called the commandment to believe in the God who took you out of Mitzrayim. Now, the Ramban asks quite logically, how could that be ever a commandment if you don't believe in God? Who is telling you to do it? It's like you're telling an atheist, you're not allowed to be an atheist. And the atheist says, who says? He says, God. Yeah. Well, yeah, but I don't believe there's a God that tells me that. So Ramban learns Anochi is not a mitzvah at all. So by definition, according to Ramban, the Ten Commandments, or Dibros, cannot be translated Ten Commandments because the first one isn't a commandment. Now, Maimonides, Rambam, does say there is a commandment here, and the commandment is addressed to a believer, one who believes in Hashem, but one who believes in Hashem because of tradition, because of Mesorah, and Hashem says you are obligated to convince yourself through a rational philosophical process that there is an Almighty. And this is the source of the Rambam's Chiyuv, to have what is called Emuna Bederech HaChakira. Chakira is philosophical, although the yeshiva world appropriated it for a slightly different definition, but the standard meaning of Chakira is philosophical, intellectual investigation, and this was the basis of the Rambam's work in the Mori Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, where the Rambam utilized Aristotelian philosophy and terminology to try to prove rationally in the existence of God. Again, I don't want to repeat everything last week because I want to go on to the next one, but suffice it to say that the Rambam's position has been very controversial, particularly since the Hasidic movement. And as you may know, generally speaking, intellectual investigation into the philosophical proofs of God is actually frowned upon within the mainstream religious community on the theory that once you open a Pandora's box, all sorts of things come out and it's better not to get into it. In fact, the only place where this is done to some degree in the Kirov movement, although not totally there either, simply because once, well, kids who are coming from secular universities, the Pandora's box has already been opened, and as a result, there's kind of an obligation to clean up the garbage. But in a mainstream black hat yeshiva, whatever you do, generally speaking, the Mori Nevuchim isn't even on the bookshelf, and it's certainly not learned very much. I will leave it for you to discuss with your own spiritual advisors as to which path is advisable. My point here is simply to say that there is the path of the Ramban and there is the path of the Rambam, and these do represent two different shitos in Klal Yisrael on the issue of Emuna. Okay, should Emuna, and of course the Hasidic movements, later, especially Rav Nachman of Breslov, emphasized very much the greatness of what is called Emuna Peshuta, simple, blind faith that does not depend on philosophical reasoning. Of course, we have a little maisa from the Chazon Ish, just a little story, it's not about this directly, where the Chazon Ish had a book somehow on the history of philosophy, and in that book there was a statement in Hebrew that says, all the philosophers up to Kant are batel u'mevutel, they're not worth anything. So the Chazon Ish added a little marginal note for some reason, ad v'yad b'chlal, including, yeah, so I don't know. Okay, but anyway, let's go now to the second commandment, or the second statement.
Did you say up to who?
Kant? Kant, Immanuel Kant, yes.
That's
what I thought. Yeah. Although I did read another Maisa that Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, who was fluent in German,
used to read the Critique of Pure Reason in the bathroom. So that was his bathroom reading, was Immanuel Kant. So, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, we now come to the second statement, and I'm not going to translate it as commandment because the second statement itself contains a number of commandments. Sentence number one, Lo yielcha Elohim acheru, read Elohim because he's referring to other forces. You shall not have any other gods, small g, al panai, in front of me. Of course, and God is everywhere, so that means no matter where you are, you shall not believe in any other gods. Now, that first statement is a little ambiguous. You shall not have any other gods. So there are actually two interpretations in the Rishonim as to what that sentence includes. Some say it refers to a physical prohibition of possession of objects of idolatry. In other words, you're not allowed to own Buddhas. You're not allowed to own idols. You're not allowed to own objects of worship, even if you yourself do not worship idols. You yourself do not practice idolatry. The Torah prohibits ownership. Now, seen in that literal way, Lo yielcha means you shall not have is the same as thou shalt not possess or own. And Elohim simply refers to the notion of idols or objects of idolatry. This would halakhically raise some questions. Am I allowed to own? You know, I go to the Far East and I buy various things. Am I allowed to own them? Again, there are questions because it's brought down in the poskim that, generally speaking, mass-produced tshatshkes, if they themselves, I mean Buddhas even, if they themselves are not the thing that people bow down to, technically they are representations of idolatrous objects, but they themselves are not idolatrous objects. Again, there are questions about that. But I want to point out, most Rishonim do not interpret this commandment as referring to ownership and possession. There might be other commandments that bear on this, but rather it refers to belief. Thou shalt not have any other gods is a prohibition. It's kind of the negative of Anochi. It is a prohibition to believe in duality or multiplicity or any type of notion that God shares his sovereignty with other forces in the world. The word Elohim is an interesting word. When we pronounce it Elohim, it is a reference to God's divinity, even though it's a plural term, but it takes a singular verb, Bereshit bara Elohim. But Elohim, when it's not referring to God, simply can refer to powers. In the Chumash, Elohim is even used to refer to judges, courts, the court system. Elohim refers also to the natural forces that God has implanted in Bria, whether it's gravity or relativity or whatever, and technically those are called the angels of God. The reference to angels is not only kind of human-like entities with wings, but it also refers to the physical laws with which God runs the universe. The laws of physics and chemistry are called Elohim, and in fact, the Mekubalim point out that the gematria of Elohim, when it refers to God, is the same as Hateva, nature. Because Elohim is God operating through nature. In fact, the common dichotomy that everyone knows, that Yudke Vavke is the name of mercy, and Elohim is the name of Din. Right? This is a common understanding. But people think that Din refers to punishments. Not necessarily. Din refers, right, judgment refers to regularity. When God conceals his active presence and things run on kind of an automatic pilot based on the normal laws of nature, but there's hester upon him, that is the Shem Elokim. The Midas HaDin in Kabbalah is not so much a Midah of punishment as it is a Midah of withdrawal and concealments from active intervention. So, Lo yielcha Elohim acherim means you cannot ascribe autonomous power and authority to all of the forces of nature
that God has created in the world. Unlike the Umot HaOlam, who might worship the sun or the moon or whatever, we believe that all of those forces are subordinate to God. They are not autonomous. Now, whether they have intelligence, that's an interesting issue. I mean, the average scientist would deny the idea that the sun has a mind or whatever it is. And yet, the Rambam does discuss Kochavim and Mazalot as having some type of das. That's a separate issue, but their das is not autonomous. Their das is controlled by God, and that is why we do not believe you can pray to any of these forces, and that includes not praying to the souls of the righteous. Right? All of the Svarim tell us that even if one visits the graves of tzaddikim, one never, God forbid, prays to the dead. One prays to Hashem that in the merit of the righteous, Hashem should give us a Yeshua. Some people might misunderstand this. Some people sometimes might pray to the dead, but that's not that's not correct. Although, what was it? The what? Well, my well, yeah. What was the story? A woman once went to Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. This is apropos of nothing, but it just reminded me of it. And she was crying because she says, all of my friends can go pray at the graves of their parents. He says, Nebuch says, my parents are alive. I have no one to pray to. You know, it's a little... So the Talmidim started laughing, but Rabbi Chanan said, you know, when a person is in distress, no matter how irrational their argument, one never disparages someone that is suffering distress. But this is the idea. But this is an idea that we sometimes glorify the dead more than the living. Now, I want to point out an interesting point. Maimonides writes, Rambam writes that the origin of Avodah Zarah and paganism was actually L'shem Shamayim. And it came out from the following way. In the days of Enosh, this is before Noach, this is all the way back, in the days of Enosh, the Rambam says, the world began to make a big mistake. And they began to reason that Hashem is so powerful and so infinite. How dare we approach Hashem directly? What, you're going to go to the prime minister or the president and ask, you know, to fix your, mow your lawn or whatever it is? It's a chutzpah. So the cheshbon was, let us worship God's servants, the sun, the moon, the lower forces. And in that way, our kavana would be, we would give glory to Hashem. So the Rambam writes Beferish that the origin of Avodah Zarah was a misguided attempt to worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu by turning to the lower Mishor Sim, the lower servants. It was L'shem Shamayim. And it was only later it then degenerated. Actually, we have two different takes here. The Rambam learns that the impulse to idolatry was a spiritual religious impulse coming from the awe of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that we are so overwhelmed with the awe and the grandeur of the Almighty that we come in fear and trepidation that we dare not approach Him. And therefore we turn to the secretaries and the undersecretaries and the like. There is another view in Chazal, which is not the Rambam's view, that says idolatry had a different type of origin, and that was, it was a way of indulging. In other words, it's kind of the old story about the person who somebody saw he had an archery target, and all of his arrows were always right in the middle of the bullseye. So someone said, gee, that's pretty amazing. How do you get every arrow? And he says, well, that's very simple. I shoot my arrows and then I draw the bullseye around the arrow. The concept was, the Gemara indicates, that people were looking for a religion that would allow them to do whatever they wanted to do. He said, you know, Judaism, it has its good points, but you know, it's pretty restrictive. You can't do this, you can't do that. But this idolatrous religion says we can have, you know, whatever sexual immorality, and eat whatever we want to eat. So according to one interpretation in the Gemara, Avodah Zarah did not originate from a religious impulse, but it originated from a hedonistic impulse, the idea of, let's create a religious system that allows us to do what we want. One can write an interesting essay
on whether these are two different views or they represent maybe Avodah Zarah at different times. In other words, is Avodah Zarah an expression of hedonism, or is Avodah Zarah an expression of displaced religious fervor in which one really had a great awe of God? But there is a bit of support for the Rambam's view in the following drasha. The Gemara in Sanhedrin discusses that beginning of the Second Temple, when Ezra was alive and Ezra gathered the 120 elders to be the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the people of the Great Assembly, and this was an extremely important body. They essentially preserved Yiddishkeit after the 70 years of the Babylonian exile. They were the ones who wrote most of our liturgy, including the Shemona Esrei and the like. And one of their problems was that, the temple was destroyed and the main Avera was Avodah Zarah. But Avodah Zarah is so destructive and they're afraid it's going to happen again, it's going to rear its ugly head. So they actually asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu to take away the Yetzer Hara for idolatry, which is an unusual request, because the one thing Hashem does not like to interfere with is free will and free choice. And the Gemara tells us they fasted for 3 days and three nights, and a fiery lion left the Kodesh HaKadoshim into the Judean desert. And that represents the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah that ran into the desert and disappeared. This is a Gemara in Maseches Yuma. So the Anshei Knesset HaGdola themselves were pretty surprised that HaKadosh Baruch Hu took away. And this is why we don't have the Yetzer Hara for idols. Because why don't we have this Yetzer Hara? It was taken away. They then figured, we were successful in getting rid of the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah. Let's try the Yetzer Hara for Giloy Arayos, sexual impropriety. So they fasted, and that was taken away too. But what happened was people weren't getting married, chickens were not laying eggs. In other words, basically, you couldn't take away the bad one without taking away the necessary good one, so therefore it came back. Okay, some things are not divisible, so to speak, so that had to exist. But here is the thing. Isn't it a peculiar description that the Yetzer Hara of idolatry is described as a fiery lion emanating from the Kodesh HaKadoshim? The Holy of Holies? That's Avodah Zarah? But according to the Rambam, it actually is understandable. Because the origin of Avodah Zarah came from the notion of God being above us, beyond us, inaccessible, unattainable. And it came from the reverence of Hashem that was so overwhelming that we could only turn to the lower forces. Now, that was taken away from us because it led us astray. But here we see an amazing idea. We actually lost something good when we lost the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah, and that is, we lost the sensitivity to the divine that we had previously. Because how many of us really think, we see this in our Sfarim, but how many of us, when we get up to Davin, are so overwhelmed with the fact that we're standing before Hashem, that we can't even open our mouths? You say, sure, we're going to... I mean, Baruch Hashem, it's a good thing that you daven. Sure, we'll daven. In other words, it doesn't occur to us that somehow, I'm trembling. I come to Hashem with fear and trepidation. Which means the following. Hashem took away some of the reverence we have for Him to make it more possible for us to approach Him. Because otherwise the reverence would have been so debilitating and paralyzing that it would have led to Avodah Zarah. But it's like the old joke they would say about lobotomies, and they used to do lobotomies, which Baruch Hashem are far and few between today, but sometimes still occasionally employed, that you cut out sections of the brain, so there goes the piano lessons or whatever it is. In other words, sometimes when you cut out something, or even an amputation of a limb, it may be necessary, but there's a cost. And I would submit to you that losing the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah had a cost. we became spiritually diminished, less sensitive, less feeling of God's grandeur and God's awe. And that is why that could be the explanation of a comment of the Vilna Gaon, where the Vilna Gaon says, the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah was replaced by a Yetzer Hara for money. So if we want to know how strong was the feeling for Avodah Zarah, then we should look at how strong the feeling is today for material comforts and money, which is the new Avodah Zarah, maybe not so new anymore, but it was the successor of Avodah Zarah. But you see, that's really a diminishment, because the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah emanated from a sense of the greatness of Hashem. Our passions have been diverted from the greatness of Hashem to the greatness of material comfort. Essentially, the concept basically was, to say it in a bit of a cruel way, but of course I include myself because I too, and we're all in the same boat, but essentially Hashem made a decision based on the Anshei Knesset HaGdola to take away potential greatness in exchange for a conforming mediocrity. Because the concept is, greatness has its downsides. Again, even in the yeshiva world, there were some analogies like this. The great Slobodka yeshiva in Europe, under the altar of Slobodka, produced many, many exceptional gedolim. Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, my Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Ruderman, many, many other, Rav Huttner, really all of the Rosh Yeshivas who came to America were Slobodka, basically Slobodka graduates. Rav Shachar was in Slobodka for a while as well. But Slobodka also produced, of all the yeshivas, the largest share of apikorsim. And these were apikorsim were very, very famous. Harry Wolfson was a great, great scholar of Jewish philosophy, but unfortunately not a maimon for most of his life. Now, the concept was, because the altar of Slobodka had a shita, that you encourage and you foster individuality and creativity. Now, that creates gedolim, and it creates apikorsim. As opposed to many other yeshivas, which focused more on a conforming type of model, where people had to be somewhat lockstep. Now, the safety of lockstep is you have less potential for deviation, but you also have less potential for the greatness of individual self-expression. As parents, you know that this is an issue that you grapple with every day in terms of how you raise your children, what type of school do you choose, right? And again, I am just here to highlight the fact that this is a great dilemma. The fostering of autonomy creates the potential for greatness, but in that potential there is risk. The kind of not going down that direction creates perhaps, it's not guaranteed there either, perhaps a greater margin of safety, although there's no guarantees in any situation, but it also kind of limits the potential for greatness. So in the Anshei Knesset HaGdola's case, they opted for stability at the sacrifice of spiritual greatness. And this is the idea of the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah. So we don't really understand what that Yetzer Hara is, because as it were, our spiritual yearnings have been diminished through the mice of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Okay, but this is why the Torah makes so many details about Avodah Zarah, because Avodah Zarah, indeed, for someone who experiences the Yad Hashem, Avodah Zarah almost seems like an appropriate option in many, many ways, because the concept is, I will serve Hashem by worshiping the servants. I am not worthy to directly serve Hashem. Yeah.
My understanding is that it wasn't just for the Jewish people, but it was in the world. So how do we understand things like Hinduism and some of the other Avodah Zarahs that are still being practiced?
Well, you know, I have to go back to the Gemara exactly. I think not. In other words, you understood that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola took it away from the entire world, or took it away from the Jewish people in particular.
But when I've asked rabbis about how do we understand that they have such a drive,
yes,
to the Avodah Zarah, they
yes,
say we can't understand it because it doesn't exist in the world today. Do they mean then that it doesn't exist for the Jewish people in the world, or that people don't have the same passion yet involved?
Well, I think that the primary idea is that it was taken away from the Jewish people, but the concept is since what happens to the Jewish people affects the world, so by definition, it exists in a residual kind of like an appendix form hanging around, but it doesn't have its vitality anymore. So even though there might be many, many people to worship, it's a non-vital type of force. In fact, the Gemara in Chulin actually has that remark. The Gemara in Chulin says, Ovdei Kochavim, you know, idol worshippers, are really pure today because they are just following Minhag Avoseihem Biyadeihem. They are just following custom. They don't have that vital belief which connects them. And in fact, if you talk to a Hindu today, they will. That's why they're always saying, it's not idolatry, and it's not that. In other words, nobody wants to call it idolatry because it's understood that idolatry isn't really something real today, even if the forms are still there. So forms can survive well after the vitality that inspired them has been dissipated. So I think that would be what you have there. Alright, but to continue therefore into the halachas. So lo yiel lecha, according to most Rishonim, is the prohibition against belief in duality or multiplicity. Now, but then it goes on. Now this is still the second commandment. Let's see how many commandments. So that's one. Lo sase lecha pesel. Do not make for yourself an idol or a graven image, which is still in that second, so-called second commandment, is a second mitzvah. And here Rashi explains, and this is how the Rambam defines it, lo sase lecha is the prohibition to manufacture objects that others will worship as idols, even if you yourself will not worship them. So lo yiel lecha is the prohibition on belief. Lo sase lecha, we might call, is the prohibition on the facilitation of others worshiping idols by you making them. Now, actually, it does not say beferish not to sell them. One can raise questions here. What if I'm an idol seller, but I'm not an idol maker? Am I transgressing? Well, technically you're not transgressing this one, but there might be other prohibitions, such as not putting a stumbling block before a blind man. So Avraham Avinu was quite right, although that was before Matan Torah, in smashing the idols, because you're not supposed to make idols to enable other people to worship. Now, this does raise an interesting question. There are in New York, and probably in Israel too, but there are Hasidim in the jewelry business, and very firm people, and they sell crosses, crucifixes. They sell all sorts of stuff that are worn by worshippers of Christianity. And the question is: are you allowed? Are you allowed to traffic, to do business, to even order the manufacture of things like crosses and crucifixes? Once again, it's tricky because it goes back to the distinction I mentioned before between actual objects that are worshipped versus objects that are representations of objects that are worshipped. So for example, so to sell the crucifix that is worshipped in the church is different than the crucifix that somebody might wear around their neck where they don't directly worship it, but it's more of a reminder. But it's tricky. Certainly, a Baal Nefesh, if you're asking a Rav, should you go into that business, you will generally be advised it is better not to. Yeah.
It's funny, but most of the vendors of the crucifixes and paraphernalia in St. Peter's Square are all Jews.
Are Jews in Rome. Yeah. Wow, okay. That's interesting. Yeah. Now,
to rationalize anything, why am I doing this?
Well, let me point out the following. There is a shita, there is a very interesting shita of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam was Rashi's grandson. Remember, he's called Tam because his name was Yaakov ben Meir. And Yaakov Avinu is described in the Torah as Ish Tam, a perfect person. So Rabbeinu Tam, Rav Yaakov ben Meir, was so venerated in his generation that he was called our master, the perfect one, Rabbeinu Tam. His older brother was also very famous. His older brother is known as the Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir. Rashi had no sons. Rashi had daughters, but the grandsons became great. Actually, Rashi's daughters were very learned as well. There is some evidence that some of the commentaries in the Gemara under Rashi's name were actually written by his daughters, particularly the one on Adorim. I have to say, maybe that's why in the yeshivas they don't learn the Rashi on Adorim. But okay, but I can't say that that's connected. I hope that's not the reason. But anyway, but the point is, Rabbeinu Tam has an interesting shita that Christianity, which in his definition meant Catholicism, because that was pre-Reformation, that was the only Christianity he was familiar with. Rabbeinu Tam has a shita that Catholicism is not idolatry under the Noahide law. Now, this is a very subtle distinction. For a Jew to profess Christianity would be idolatrous. But for a non-Jew, even though under the seven commandments of Noah, a non-Jew is also not allowed to practice Avodah Zarah, but Rabbeinu Tam's position is that Trinitarian Christianity, Catholicism, is non-idolatrous under the Noahide law. It is what he calls shituf. Shituf is when you endow God with human attributes. And although it's not, now he's not suggesting it's a correct belief. Obviously, if something is factually incorrect, it's not going to change if you're a Jew or a guy. But he meant it's an erroneous belief, but it is not an idolatrous belief under the Noahide law. It is only an idolatrous belief under the Jewish law. Now, that might suggest a basis of leniency. Again, I'm not getting into the halachas here, in terms of marketing these objects to Christians, since under Rabbeinu Tam's theory, this is not idolatry. Maimonides, the Rambam, absolutely argues with this. Now, in a censored part of the Rambam, which is not in the standard Rambam, the Rambam draws a clear distinction between Christianity and Islam, where the Rambam says Christianity, which again, in his view, was Catholicism, because that was the only one that he was familiar with, Catholicism is Avodah Zarah, and Islam is not, although he didn't like Muhammad. He said Muhammad was a meshuggah that did much, much harm in the world. He called him Ahu Meshuggah. He actually uses the word in one of his letters. But he still says Islam is not Avodah Zarah. Islam is a monotheistic religion, and he drew that distinction. There's also an interesting passage in that Rambam, a very, very amazing passage, which Rav Yehuda Halevi said earlier, actually, where the Rambam says there was a divine function in the spread of Christianity and Islam in the world, because it was a stepping stone to wean idolatrous pagans towards the idea of what you might call ethical monotheism, and pave the road towards the eventual acceptance of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Rambam saw a Yad Hashem in the spread of these other religions that replaced, to a large degree, at least in the West, not counting the Far East, replaced in the West the multiplicity of religions that were pagan. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, so, well, this is a very good question. Where is the source of the seven Noahide laws? The source of the seven Noahide laws are in Daf Nuntes of Sanhedrin. Now, that raises a very interesting question. Does Hashem expect the average guy to be familiar with Daf Nuntes of Sanhedrin? What exactly is the assumption here? I think the assumption of classical halacha is that the ultimate source of the Noahide law was a direct divine revelation that was given to Noah and his sons after the flood, and it was part of oral traditions that were spread to all of humanity. They are written down in Sanhedrin, but in fact they are part of... So the reason Goyim are accountable is not because of Sanhedrin. They are accountable because this was considered to be a universal revelation. The seven Noahide laws, yeah.
But if the Rambam considered that Christianity is Avodah Zarah, so how is
going to
wean them off of it?
That's a very, no, that's an excellent question. In other words, there's a catch-22 there. Yeah, the answer has to be that although it is Avodah Zarah, but there are degrees even in Avodah Zarah, meaning to say it is approaching the idea, approaching, not quite there, of one God instead of many. And even though that one God has attributes of a person, etc., but it is a closer idea to pure monotheism than is Avodah Zarah, and eventually it can bring a person over. This is what he says. But you are correct. It is avodah zarah, but it's at least moving away from the many towards the idea of one. Yeah. Yes, that's true. But remember, that was during the first temple period, and the Gemara recorded that at the beginning of the second temple period, God abolished that Yetzer Hara. So yes, you are 100% correct. Avodah Zarah was rampant. Although I will say, Rabbi Victor Miller makes an interesting point. I mean, I don't think he has. Say again. Well, she mentioned Moloch. I was just discussing Avodah Zarah. But Rabbi Avigdor Miller makes an interesting point. He argues that even though the Tanakh describes the Jewish people doing the most awesome, awful averos, idolatry and, you know, sacrificing their children, which is Moloch, and all sorts of very bad things, he suggests at no time was it ever more than a small minority of the Jewish people. And the fact that the Tanakh and the Nevi'im criticize Am Yisrael so much, it's not because everybody was doing it, but it's because the righteous did not take steps to stop it. And just like by the Chayto Egel, right, a whole Jewish people gets punished for the sin of the golden calf, when in fact the actual worshippers were not very much. So Rabbi Miller claims this idea that you get from Tanakh, that like everybody was doing these bad averos, he claims that's not the intention of the psukim itself. I don't know. I mean, again, he based it on the words of Doros HaRishon. Doros HaRishonim is a very famous history of the Jewish people that was written by Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi at the end of the 19th century. He was a great, great Talmud Chacham and a great historian. And he was very creative, though, and sometimes some of his assumptions. So it's not always clear that that's an accurate reading of history, but it's certainly a possible reading, because we do find throughout the Torah the idea that because every Jew is responsible for every other Jew, we do find that the averus of even a small segment are attributed to the people. Okay, so lo yiel lecha is prohibition on belief. Lo sasa lecha, we will paraphrase, is a prohibition on facilitation by making idols. And then it says, lo tishtachav, number three, lo tishtachav elohem, do not bow down to them. Lo sa'avdeim, do not worship them. So, in the so-called second commandments, we have four commandments, indeed. Lo yielcha, lo saselcha, lo tishtachaveh, lo sa'avdeim. Right, so already, you know, calling it the second commandment is totally inaccurate. There are four commandments in the so-called second statement. Now, I want to explain a little bit what number three and four is. And here I have to be a little technical, but not too much so. There, Avodah Zarah, Baruch Hashem, it's not so shechiach today, so not too many rabbis get questions in Avodah Zarah. Of course, we did get a recent question. That was the issue of shekels from India, which in fact actually raised questions. Are we allowed to benefit, right? Because the question was, a lot of the, at least some of the human hair shekels came from women in India who cut their hair in honor of the worship of the Hindu god, and then it gets sold by the temples, etc. And there actually was a halakhic question whether those shekels were avodah zarah, which you're not allowed to use or get benefit from. So it is nice. I mean, basically, it's like HaKadosh Baruch Hu sometimes gives us opportunities to re-explore corners of the Torah that somehow get ignored because they're not of practical use. So Baruch Hashem, so Kuntrasim came out explaining the laws of Avodah Zarah. It was good. As you know, Rebbe Yoshev initially asserted, then more recently there are Haterim. I don't want to get into... Right, right, yes, that's correct. I don't want to get into that.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, yeah, all right, but I don't want to get into that. Of course, in my neighborhood, I walk by signs every day. You're not allowed to wear a shekel, so it's not in my neighborhood. It's not nogeya lemaisa. But anyway, the thing is that let me go over a few halachas. Under the laws of the Torah, avodah zarah is actually a capital crime. Meaning, if a person bows down to an idol when there was a Beis HaMikdash, and two witnesses saw him, and two witnesses told him, don't do it, and he did it, he could be put to death for avodah zarah, and the punishment is stoning. Yeah. Now, stoning does not mean throwing stones. Stoning actually means pushed off a cliff, and then stones are dumped on him, etc. But this is avodah zarah. There's a special rule: if a whole city worshipped avodah zarah, they get eradicated with the sword. That's called ir hanidachas, and their property is burnt as well. Now, avodah zarah has the following technicalities, though, and this is the following: in order to be chayav misa for avodah zarah, you either have to worship it the way it is customarily worshipped, or you do things that are inherently considered worshipful. By that I mean the following. There's avodah zarah root A and avodah zarah root B. Root A is the idiosyncratic ways that an idol is worshipped. Every idol has its own had its own ways of worship. Some idols were worshipped even by defecation, such as Baal Peor. Now, if one defecates to Baal Peor, even if their internal motivation is to shame that worship, he has committed a type A act of worship for which he's chayav misa. Right? So type A is whatever you do that is called the derech of avoda, and that is the lav lo sa'av deim. Thou shalt not worship idols, meaning thou shalt not do what is customarily done to worship the idol, irrespective of your subjective intention. Now, type B is the following. Certain aspects of service are called inherently reverential, even if the idol is not worshipped that way. And therefore, if you do it, that's a type B avodah zarah. And those activities include bowing down. They include slaughtering and offering a korban. They include pouring wine. Right? So we have a zivuach, and sacrificing. So slaughtering a korban or sacrificing. So the way it works is the following. Let's take Baal Peor. Let's imagine Baal Peor was only worshipped by defecation. It was not worshipped by bowing or korban. But if I bring a korban, I'm still chayav because that's type B of avodah zarah. Okay, so the difference between bowing down, lo tishtachav Elohim, v'lo sa'av deim, is lo tishtachav is what I call, should have reversed it, but that's what I call type B. That is, do not perform acts of reverence for idolatry, such as bowing, korbanos, wine libation, incense, even if that's not the way the idol is worshipped. And lo sa'av deim means do not worship the idol the way it is worshipped, even if it's non-reverential. So reverential, even if that's not the way it's worshipped. The way it's worshipped, even if it's not reverential. Now, this is what we would call the objective idea of avodah zarah, meaning the following. You can't do these things even if you're doing it under duress, under compulsion, and you don't believe in it. Right? That's the rule that says if someone goes over to you and says, bow down to the idol or I'll kill you, you must give your life. Now, you might make the philosophical argument, well, wait a second. If the essence of avodah zarah is the acceptance of something as a god, well, as long as I don't accept it in my mind, isn't that enough? So the answer is, lo tishtachave lohem velosa of deim is what we would call the objective aspect of idolatry, meaning you are not allowed to perform certain actions which would be interpreted as worship, even if subjectively that is not your intention. In fact, that's the difference between lo yeh lecha and the other ones. Lo yeh lecha is a reference to belief systems. Do not believe in these other forces. Lo tishtachaveh lohem v'lo sa'avdeim. Do not pertain to belief. They pertain to external behaviors. And that, otherwise, it wouldn't make sense. Otherwise, to say I must give up my life before bowing down to an idol would actually not make any sense. Because anybody who's bowing down to an idol because they're afraid they'll get killed otherwise is by definition not affirming a belief in the divinity of the idol. Now, if Avodah Zarah depended exclusively on internal belief, then it would be a logical inconsistency to say, I must give up my life before transgressing Avodah Zarah, because I would never transgress Avodah Zarah if I'm acting under duress. Do you follow the argument here? So the argument, therefore, is Avodah Zarah has both a subjective component, meaning one cannot entertain certain beliefs, but it also has a behavioral objective component. And it is that behavioral component that requires the Jew to give up their life before they engage in it. Having said that, the Rambam has a very interesting tshuva, which is consistent with his belief. The Rambam was sent a letter. Now, the Rambam lived most of his life in Egypt. And this was during a period of intense Islamic persecutions. The Almohads were a kind of fanatic. They were like the Al-Qaeda of the time, but they were acting for religious reasons, supposedly, and they were basically threatening non-Muslims with death unless they would convert, unless they would say Allah Akbar, whatever, which just means God is great. There's nothing actually so bad about the statement per se, but they would have to accept Muhammad. God is great, and the next part of the sentence, Muhammad is his prophet. So the Rambam was sent a question from the communities of Yemen. Were they obligated to give up their lives before they said such things? So the Rambam actually permitted them. The Rambam permitted them to adopt externally Islam without giving their lives. But the Rambam gave two different reasons. One reason is his general opinion, as we said before, that Islam is not Avodah Zarah. But then he said another reason, which is very surprising, because that could kick into Christianity as well. He says, if even the Islamists know you don't really mean it, and it's insincere, it does not become a profession of idolatry if nobody is being fooled. That's the old line that any lie that nobody believes might not be a lie because nobody is deceived thereby. Now, that's a pretty amazing thing. I mean, that the Rambam seems to suggest. Yes, the Rambam articulates a svara that if somebody is persecuting you and they know you don't really believe what you're saying, so you're allowed to say it, because you're not really giving anybody the impression that you're renouncing Yiddishkeit. Now, I want to say that that's a big, big chiddush. And in the Rambam's halachic book, the Mishnah Torah, he makes no mention of that whatsoever. So it's very interesting that in the Igeres Teiman, he perhaps was offering comfort and solace to people who were not able to be Omeid B'Nisayon, but he sometimes indicated halachic reasoning that did not find its way in the final halachic source. Because according to that, I mean, if you go with that if they know you don't believe it, I mean, that would justify, in the Spanish Inquisition, that would justify all sorts of things. That's correct. According to that reasoning, Chana may have acted beyond the halacha, and not necessarily the halacha. But as I say, that part of the Rambam, generally speaking, has not been halacha. Let me give you another aspect of this idea of having to give up your life before you worship Avodah Zarah. This happened during World War II quite a lot. So if a guy goes over to me and says, believe in Yashkar, I'll kill you, so putting aside the Rambam's reasoning, generally speaking, a Jew must give his life before he says, I believe. Can a Jew impersonate himself as a Christian? In other words, well, Holocaust, right? You pass yourself off as a goy. Does it make a difference if you're just doing it by dressing a certain way? Or can you actually say the words, I'm a Christian, etc.? So the Shach, who by the way lived and was actually, he died in the Khmelnytsky massacres, so the Shach was a victim of a pogrom himself, but the great Shach actually writes, and this is a subtle distinction, there is a distinction between impersonation and renunciation. When the Torah says you must give up your life before you renounce, renouncing is when people know you're Jewish and you're now saying, I repudiate my faith. A Jew must die before they repudiate their faith. But you see, that's not what happened in the Holocaust. If somebody would come forward and say, I'm Jewish, but I believe in Yeshua, that's not going to help you. In fact, there is a woman that was canonized by the Catholic Church, Edith Stein, who converted to Christianity. In fact, she's now a saint in the Catholic Church, and she died in Auschwitz. You know, so the only way you can get out of the Holocaust situation is not by saying, I'm Jewish, but I renounce, but by simply passing yourself off as a goy from the very beginning. The Shach says that is not repudiation. Repudiation is when you say, I'm a Jew, or I was a Jew, and I am rejecting. When you pass yourself off as somebody else, that is what is called mistaken identity. And the Shach actually rules that you're allowed to do that. And of course, the truth of the matter is, Kama v'kama gedolim did pass themselves off as a Christian, including shaving off their beard and other things in order to escape Europe. So they followed this Shach lahalacha lamaisa.
Yeah. But when they had to wear crucifixes, was that going over the line?
It might be, but according to the Shach, even then, as long as you're not representing yourself as a Jew who is renouncing, you're impersonating somebody else. They said that might be a difference. So, you know, so there is a difference there. But actually, some drew another distinction, which is a kind of a curious distinction. If the guy asks you, "Are you a Jew or not? Are you a Jew?" So, someone say that in German you were allowed to say "Kein Yid," because in German, "Kein Yid" means there's no Jew here. But in Ivrit, Kein Yid, yes, I'm a Jew. So they say, as long as you use a lashon, that might be interpreted as non-renunciation. So you wouldn't be allowed to say, according to that, that's stricter than the Shach. You wouldn't be allowed to say, I'm not a Jew, but you can use a lashon that has double mashmas. All right, so Bekitzer, what we see is that in this second commandment, we have no fewer than four distinct prohibitions. Do not believe in other forces. Do not make idols to facilitate other people to worship. Do not engage in reverential activities like bowing and sacrificing, even if that's not the way the idol is worshipped. And finally, do not engage in the way the idol is worshipped, even if it's not the way you would express reverence. And those are what we call the objective Avodah Zarah aspects, rather than the subjective. Now, I'll stop here, but then it goes on. And in this second commandment, which is fairly long, it gives us some important philosophy and theology that we have to think about, because I am the Lord your God, who is a jealous God, who visits the sin of the fathers unto the children, unto the third generation and the fourth generation, and does acts of loving kindness to those who love me and those who keep my mitzvahs. Now here, we'll save this for next week, but here the question that the Mefarshim deal with, the Gemara deals with, is obvious. The Torah says specifically, God will visit the sins of the fathers onto the later generations. But do we not have other verses that say, sons shall not die for the sins of the fathers, nor shall fathers die for the sins of the sons? Each person is responsible for their own chatoyim. So you have a contradiction in the Torah itself between poked avon avos al banim and ish b'cheto yumas. Right, so we'll talk about that. I just want to point out one final point that Gemara does make, though, very beautifully. It does say that as harsh as this pasuk is, you see that God is 500 times more generous than he is vindictive. Because when it comes to punishing the children for the father's sins, God will punish up to the fourth generation. So that's son, grandson, great-grandson. You're including the sinner as the first. It goes no further. When it comes to those who keep mitzvahs, God keeps the zechus for 2,000 generations. Right? So the ratio between 4 and 2,000 is 1 to 500. So the Gemara says in many places that Hashem's Midah of Tova is Chamesh Meos, is 500 times more than the Midah of Prunes. But we'll talk about this next week. Have a good day.